Our body renews itself by eating itself, and Yoshinori Osumi won the Nobel Prize for figuring out how. And so we ask, how does our body renew itself by eating itself?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,192nd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Firenze who are tuned in on the podcast as we stream along at the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, a while back I had the opportunity to go on an herb walk with a Shipibo shaman in the Peruvian Amazon. At one point along the trail, the shaman stopped to pass around a jug of jungle juice from which we each had a pull or two, or maybe even three. The interpreter said it would change the way we saw things, and it did. When the shaman stopped again to describe the medicinal properties of the Uno de Gato plant, my gaze fixed on a leaf that had fallen to the ground. By fixed, I mean my sight zoomed right down to that leaf and focused on the myriad of tiny creatures that were consuming it. From the voracity of their feasting, I realized that neither weakness nor death lasts very long in the Amazon. Life is simply too competitive to allow for weakness and too hungry to allow nutrients to be locked up by the dead. So both weakness and death are quickly recycled back into life. It has been known for some time that a process like the one I observed in the Amazon goes on in the human body. That process is called autophagy, which in the Greek says self-eating. Crudely translated, autophagy means our body renews itself by eating itself. What is now known, thanks to the Nobel Prize-winning research of Yoshinori Osumi of Japan, is how autophagy works. Osumi's discovery is quickly opening a brave new world of medical possibilities, and the big money venture capital is pouring in. But for the most, those possibilities seem to lie in the future, so today we pause to ask, how does our body heal itself and renew itself by eating itself? To find an answer, we are traveling way down deep into the body's cells with Dr. Richard Veerstra, who is the professor of biology at Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Veerstra, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, thanks for the invitation.
Pleasure to have you aboard. And let me state at the outset, it wasn't easy to find you. For some reason, people are were very reluctant to talk about autophagy, or autophagy, as they say on the other side of the pond. But we're grateful that you're here and you have been well spoken for by the people who are there at Washington University, which does seem to be a very active university in the field of autophagy. Is that not true?
Yes, there's a lot of people working on it from a variety of angles, both from looking at it, how it affects like plant senescence, to all the way the processes like Alzheimer's and various neurological disorders.
Well, in preparing for the show, I ran across a Q&A between a writer by the name of Ryan Cross of Chemical and Engineering Magazine and Dr. David Perlmutter, who is a dean of the Washington University School of Medicine. And it was a pretty interesting comment, so I thought I'd lay it on the table here to help open our conversation. Perlmutter said of autophagy, it has enormously palpable potential. Yet when the author Cross asked what autophagy's biggest disease-cutting potential is, Perlmutter's answer is one that is echoed throughout the field of biology. And he said, autophagy is important in a lot of things. He said, none of them stand out because all of them look interesting. So I got to wondering, with respect to autophagy, are you cell biologists and geneticists feeling a bit like kids in a candy store?
Well, I guess I would say that's true, and that is that, you know, people were trying to understand how cells cleanse themselves of their debris, you know, for a long period of time. And there's been two major pathways that have come from this, And the first one that really garnered a lot of the attention early on was what's called the ubiquitin 26S proteasome pathway, which is a rather unique one in which what cells do is they attach ubiquitins, a small protein, to other proteins and tag them for degradation. And these proteins are then degraded by a very large proteolytic machine called the 26S proteasome. Mm-hmm. And so people thought, well, that's really how everything works. And the pathway is enormous. You know, it's like, you know, in the organism that I study, Arabidopsis thaliana, a little plant, it's like 6% of the genome is this pathway. But then people like Osumi then started working on another pathway that people really didn't know much about. And this is this autophagy pathway. Mm-hmm. And it's a different pathway. And so instead of tagging proteins to say, get rid of you, specifically through the breakdown by the proteasome, what it does is it engulfs these proteins en masse in big sort of vesicles. And then those vesicles are dragged to basically a graveyard. The vacuole in plants and yeast or the lysosome in animal cells, which then eats everything in, it eats both the vesicle and all its contents. Well, some people thought, oh, that's pretty interesting. But now we're just realizing just how complicated that pathway is.
Right. So the very core of it is that our cells have a process for taking out the trash.
Exactly.
But not only taking it out the trash, but recycling that trash.
Right. And also deciding what trash is.
There you go.
What is trash and what is not trash?
Well, my wife and I have that discussion often when it gets right down to it. Is this trash or should we keep it?
That's right.
There you go. Well, let's begin with the cells and you know, for those people out there who skipped high school biology, what exactly are cells?
So the cells are basically bags of enzymatic activities and genetic material that allows you to propagate that those enzymatic activities from generation to generation. So all the genetic information is stored in the nucleus, but all the business of the cell is really in this sort of what's called the cytoplasmic mix.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and in there, there's all kinds of enzymes that basically allow our cells to run and grow and develop.
Well, how many of those little bags of enzymes are in our body?
Well, oh yeah, it's probably a billion.
A billion, good. And are they smart? Are they intelligent? Do they talk with each other?
They communicate with each other a lot. So they send signals to each other saying, you do this, you do that, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And so it helps coordinate, for example, development of us from a single fertilized egg to the complex, organism that a human being is. And then it also then keeps those cells maintained over that course of time we live, and then eventually also helps us respond to things that are going on around us. So it helps us respond, for example, to stress.
And how do they live and breathe?
How do they live and breathe? Well, they live and breathe by basically converting energy into biological compounds that help drive reactions. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we have to continually eat. So we continually eat so we can make high-energy compounds that help drive all these reactions. And so, you know, some of those reactions, for example, are making sugars, making proteins, making nucleic acids, making DNA, or they're, for example, importing ions into the cell to help maintain what's called osmotic pressure and right osmotic balance so enzymes can function. And so it's a very regulated environment.
Well, what happens when they get old and tired and go bad?
When they get old? Well, that's where the problems begin. And that's why things like autophagy and the proteasome pathway, for example, have become highly relevant to medicine. And that is that we're starting to learn that when cells live for a long time, their proteins don't live forever. They begin to denature, fall apart, break down, for example. And the cell has to continually sort of cleanse itself of all this trash. So, you know, it's
just like the house,
you know, it's a Maria Kondo sort of thing, and that is that there's a lot of things that don't make cells happy.
Right.
And you've got to get rid of them.
Right. Now, the cell has a lot of information in it, and you work with plants. Well, we all know that you can take the tip of a plant and put it in a petri dish and grow a whole new plant out of it. Right. Can you take the cell of a human from me, for example, and put it in a petri dish full of nutrient solution and grow new me?
You can now do that these days. And so this is what the whole thing is with human embryonic stem cells, where you can take cells, de-differentiate them back into a embryonic state, and then convert them into whole organisms again.
Wow.
So this is the whole sort of, you know, the controversy, you know, underpinning sort of stem cell research, for example. There eventually we'll be able to clone all sorts of things. And we've already cloned sheep, and we've cloned dogs and things like that by using these techniques. And with plants, it turns out that we've been doing them for probably the last at least 50 years where we've been cloning things. And, you know, good examples of that are orchids. You know, almost all the orchids that you see today are all cloned from individual cells.
Mm-hmm. So a brave new world there popping
up in
front of us. Now, as a cell biologist, how do you go about working with a cell? Because they're awfully tiny.
Yeah, so what you have to do is you can study individual cells microscopically. So you can see how they're behaving under the microscope. And one thing that's really spearheaded a lot of that is actually the development of these fluorescent proteins that have been described. Some people won Nobel Prizes for developing them. And so these are these proteins that are fluorescent, and you can follow the fluorescence inside cells. So you can see how individual cells are behaving. But if you want to do things biochemically, most of the time what you're doing is you're doing it in populations of cells, or you're using whole tissues, organs, for example.
Mm-hmm. And then by seeing what the population does, you get a pretty good idea. So
right.
Backing up a little bit, there must be some way for the cells to decide who should do what and who's giving the orders and such from cell to cell.
That's right. So there are sort of master regulators, master cells, master regulators that then will influence the entire cell and influence actually populations of cells.
Wow.
And those cells will start off, you know, in a certain way, and then they'll differentiate into this sort of new program, mm-hmm. and it'll tell all its progeny, then you are going to do this new program.
And that's all.
And that makes a liver, for example, or makes a leaf, or makes a root.
Right.
Or makes a fly wing.
And those processes are all, you know, transmitted via chemistry, right?
Right, all transmitted via chemistry, but they're all genetically encoded. So your DNA has already determined what the pattern is going to be.
So there it is. So the instructions are there, and all the cells have to do is carry them out.
Right.
As per the directions. Wow.
And if it doesn't, if it doesn't go right, then there's severe consequences. And that underpins a lot of the genetic diseases that are, influence human life.
And as a biologist, you really have been specializing in plants, correct?
Yeah, but we use plants as really kind of a model for all organisms because, you know, we're studying basic biological processes that plants and animals and humans and insects, for example, all use. But the reason why we use plants in some ways is that it's very convenient. And as we don't have to worry about people worrying about throwing plants in blenders.
They
propagate, they make lots of individuals, so we can do experiments quite cheaply and fast. And so it really, you know, we use plants as a model for understanding
everything else. Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, Dr. Richard Vierstra. We're talking about autophagy. We're talking about how our body renews itself by eating itself. Where did this come from? We will be right back. Stay tuned for The Food Chain Radio Show.
Now, more of What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back, folks. We are talking autophagy, which it was the subject of a 2016 Nobel Prize in Medicine for a Japanese researcher by the name of Yoshimori Asumi. And it was a significant, as far as I could see, a pure layman such as I am, but it seems to have turned the world of biology on its made them stand up and pay attention, because there's been a lot of talk about the various possibilities involved in this discovery. And so everybody's kind of excited. Is that true, Dr. Vierstra? Are people pretty excited about this Nobel Prize?
Oh yeah. Well, I think you know, we all knew what the research was going on and what he had accomplished, his group had accomplished, and so the excitement had been building, and certainly then it was capped off by getting the Nobel Prize, but it's sort of continued unabated because even that early work, I don't think appreciated just how complicated, how important this whole process of autophagy is.
Well, so we understand. What did he exactly do, Dr. Virsta? What did Yoshiri Omura do?
Okay, so
what did he pry out?
Genetic experiment. And what he was trying to do is he was trying to define the factors that drive autophagy. So autophagy, you could see cells sort of eating itself in the microscope. And you could see that there was these vesicles that are coming and engulfing material inside the cell.
What's a vesicle? What is a vesicle for those? Yeah, what is a vesicle for those who do not know?
Okay, so the vesicles are called, well, they're called autophagosomes. And what they do is they start off as a cup-shaped structure, and they swallow things inside the cell, much like if your hand was just to grab, some beans out of a bag, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so people knew that process was going on, but they didn't have any way of studying it because no one knew what the components were that drove it. Okay, and so what he did was he went about trying to find the components. And by finding the components, then you can understand the underpinning machinery. You can also develop reporters that will allow you to study it in live cells, for example. And so what he did was he did a simple genetic screen where he looked for yeast cells that wouldn't make these autophagosomes, wouldn't eat itself. And how he triggered it is he just basically starved the yeast. He just put them under a media that didn't have amino acids. And so what they did was they sensed they were starving, and they started to eat themselves through autophagy.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he did was he painstakingly looked under the microscope at individual colonies of yeast and said, do you make these autophagosomes or do you not? And what he did was he took the yeast, mutagenized them to knock out all kinds of genes randomly, and then went through individually and said, which mutants don't do this anymore, don't make autophagosomes, okay? And he then identified about 30 different sort of loci that genes that were affected and no longer made autophagosomes. And so what he did was he just systematically went through and identified all the genes that did this. And he got a crazy assortment of genes that were uncharacterized at the time. And they painstakingly went through and says, what does this one do? What does that one do? What does this one do? And through that, and studies of a variety of other people that also became engaged in this, they began to piece the sort of the basic core machinery that drives this process. And that has been the sort of the boon to the whole industry or the whole field of research on autophagy, because now we could actually have mutants that would stop the process so we could understand what the effects were. And we also had the enzymes that drove it. So now we could use them as reporters to watch it happen inside live cells.
So now you can kind of poke it and see what happens.
So now you can kind of poke it, exactly.
Well, to help folks understand exactly where we're at here with respect to autophagy, maybe we should go back a little bit. The entire process was first described in 1993 by a Christian de Duve, correct?
Yeah. But it was known even earlier than that. It was seen when early micrographs, when the early electron microscopes were developed. They could see this.
Ah, well, there's three processes, I think, that really describe the process. First of all, it starts with starvation, correct?
Yes, but it's also happening all the time.
Ah.
So you are constantly eating yourself, even under sort of food-rich conditions. And you're doing this to get rid of the trash, because even under good conditions, you're making trash. But under starvation conditions, the cell says, I need amino acids. Okay, I need sugars. I need nucleic acids. I can't recycle fast enough. And so what it does, it turns it on. And so you start churning through more of these components so you can make new things.
So it's kind of like you're looking for junk to eat or, leftovers in the refrigerator.
Yeah, but sometimes you're eating good stuff.
Yeah, okay.
You know, a good example of that is that, if you starve, you eat your muscle, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't use your muscles, you also eat them, even under well-fed conditions.
So use your muscles. If you want to keep them, you got to use them, right? Huh. So during starvation or duress or any time, the cells form these membranes called phagophores. And right. It's kind of like a garbage sack in a way.
Yeah, well, that's the phagophore, that cup-shaped structure.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it seals and makes a vesicle, that's the autophagosome.
So this cup-shaped phagophore goes about the cell looking for trash.
Looking for trash.
And what tells it what's trash and what's not?
That's the question. And that's what we don't really understand yet. How does the system recognize good from bad? And that's going to be the key, for example, to understanding cures for a variety of diseases that are associated with, you know, protein recycling. How do you know good from bad? In the case of a normal well-fed cell, it's just looking for what's good or bad. In the case of a starvation system, it doesn't care what's good or bad. Sometimes it's just engulfing everything that can get its hands on, because it needs a supply of amino acids.
Yeah,
it needs making new protein. In the case of when a protein goes bad, it's really sort of unclear what makes it bad. Okay, so
mm-hmm.
there's a couple of ideas that are out there. One thing is that the proteins are marked as bad, and this is where this ubiquitin system comes in, where it sticks ubiquitins on bad proteins. Another thing that it does is that it looks like what it does, it coalesces bad stuff in sort of graveyards. And these graveyards are then sort of picked apart by the autophagic machinery and mm-hmm. degraded.
So it's kind of like put a bunch of stuff out in the garage and we'll figure out what to do with it later.
That's right, exactly. And these things can get actually quite large. They're aggregates of material, mostly protein, that accumulates in cells. And if you follow any of the literature that's involved in a variety of neurological disorders, it's these kinds of aggregates that cause neurological disorders.
Wow.
Okay, the tau protein, for example, the fibrils that show up in Alzheimer's patients. So it's these kinds of bad proteins that accumulate. Now, normally under good situations, then the cell is able to handle them through autophagy, swallow them, and then break them down. But under certain conditions, they can't do that. And that's what triggers a variety of diseases.
We have this newly created trash bag filled with bad stuff. Now, how does the cell go about eating this stuff?
Okay, that's a really interesting question. So what the cell does is the cell has sort of trash recycles inside. They're two organelles. They basically work about the same. They're called lysosomes in animals, and they're called the vacuole in plants and fungi. And these are bags filled with digestive enzymes, much like all the digestive enzymes that are found in your stomach, for example, in your intestines. And so what the cell does is that the phagophore swallows the material, creates an autophagosome, and then it takes that vesicle and it fuses it with this recycling vesicle, the lysosome or the vacuole. And what happens is that there's an inner vesicle inside that is then deposited into the from the autophagosomes into the vacuole lysosome, and that whole bag with all its contents are then broken down by these hydrolytic enzymes.
Hmm.
And so these enzymes can break down sugars, they can break down nucleic acids, they can break down fatty acids and lipids, and they can break down protein. And so what they do is they take all this stuff and disassemble it down to the core components, like amino acids.
Wow. And then turn it in from trash into something reusable again.
Right. So then that stuff is then pumped out of the vacuole lysosome, and then the cell then, for example, in the case of amino acids, just converts it into new protein again.
So what was trash is now life again.
Right, right.
Goes right back into it. So I use the example of the what I saw happen in the Amazon rainforest. Mm. Was that out of bounds with respect to autophagy, the entire process of life being continually recycled back up into
right.
the forest?
So what's happening during leaf senescence, for example, if you saw that leaf that was on the ground mm-hmm. that began to yellow, is that the autophagic system was then activated and was beginning to eat the cellular contents of those leaf cells. So what's happening in the fall is sort of a massive autophagic breakdown that's going on, where the cells are eating themselves in the leaves and then converting all those goodies into basic building blocks for new growth. And what the cell and then eventually the leaf does, it ships all that stuff out. And in the case of, for example, a maple tree, it ships it all out and sends it into the roots. And so you're filled with amino acids and sugars and so forth. And that is then used for new growth in the next spring. And so all that stuff then comes up from the leaves, from the roots back into the leaves or where the new leaves are being grown. And then you're now sort of rejuvenating the plant. And this is the basis of maple syrup. So maple syrup basically is autophagic trash recycled and dropped into the roots.
And where we tap it out, and there we are.
And when we tap it out, there we are, yep.
Well, this seems like it's a wonderful symphony.
Yeah.
Whereas everything seems to be working with everything else to keep things going.
So the thing is kind of interesting about the whole system, and you bring in sort of this sort of circle of life around, is that when biology, you know, was first discovered, DNA and so forth, what they thought was that really all cells could be explained by making new proteins. And this involved, you know, replicating DNA, transcribing DNA into RNA, RNA into proteins, and you make new proteins, and voila, you have a cell that functions. And what so the proteasome system and the autophagy has shown us is that really that's only half the equation, is that the back half, which is getting rid of those proteins, is also really critical, not only for recycling, but also just for developmental progression. So, you know, you not only have to make a protein at the right place at the right time, but you also have to get rid of it at the right place at the right time.
Because there's always trash. And you got to take out the trash. Right. If you don't take out the trash, your house will fill up, and pretty soon you'll be like the little lady that has 89 cats.
That's right, has 89 cats.
There you go. Well, so this is truly a significant breakthrough in biology then, isn't it?
Yeah. And what's made it even more significant is that, you know, the understanding, you know, initially was, okay, you make this little cup-shaped structure, okay, and it engulfs things in the cytoplasm, and it sends it over to the vacuole lysosome for being broken down, okay? But we're now understanding that what gets inside that cup-shaped structure is highly regulated.
Ah. Okay?
And so the cell does not just grab things, indiscriminately. And it actually has a series of receptors that identify the trash or what they don't want anymore. And what it does, it links it to that enveloping membrane. Okay? And so all the bad stuff lines the surface of this vesicle while it's enclosing and brings it then into the enclosed vesicle, which is eventually transported into the vacuole lysosome for degradation.
Wow.
And so it turns out that this is a highly regulated process. And so
what does the identifying then? It's a highly regulated process, but who's doing the regulating?
So who's doing all the regulating? Yeah, that's a good question. So there's receptors that we're now beginning to discover. And so who's then regulating them? And how are they knowing what's trash and what's not trash?
Because we all go through that, you know. Which recycling bin do we throw this into, right?
Exactly.
Huh. And so there it is. This is the autophagy process that is just turning the world upside down. A lot of interest in it from a number of different sources. Science, medicine, healing, just about everybody's standing up and paying attention to this whole new process called autophagy, kind of put on the table by the 2013 discovery of the processes that manage autophagy by Japanese researcher Yoshinori Asumi and team. You work with teams too, don't you, Dr. Veerstra?
Yeah. So I have a series of collaborators as well as a team in my own lab.
How does your team work?
Well, we try to figure out what's the basic questions that we want to address. So how does autophagy work? How do you identify which is trash? What makes something trash? And we use sort of model systems as well as model proteins to try to understand this process. And then we work with groups of people using a variety of different techniques, going from mass spectrometry to electron microscopy. Mm.
So you always start
with teams like that. What you want to do is, you know, you want to work with people that have expertise in those individual areas.
Mm-hmm. So you bring people in ad hoc whenever the situation calls. But you always start with a fundamental question, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So we'd say, how does this work? And then we try to use the techniques that will best address that question.
Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of interesting questions left with respect to autophagy, don't we?
Yeah. And I think the medical implications are only just beginning. For example, we just published a paper not too long ago where we identified one of the targets of autophagy. Okay, and it's a really important protein that helps survey cells and figure out what bad proteins are around, and it actually extracts them and sends them for autophagic degradation or for the ubiquitin system degradation. And what we found out is that mutants in that particular protein also targets it for degradation.
Wow.
And then what we did was we connected those mutants. It turns out those mutants that we identified are the same mutations that are found in a number of humans that get a variety of neurological disorders. So they're getting neurological disorders because this extractase protein is not functioning well and is targeted for autophagy.
Well, that's what we want to pick up when we get back. What does this autophagy bring to the table for all of us? Good, is it good? Is it bad? Is it both? Like most things, could be either and or. So we're going to tackle that with Dr. Richard Veerstra from the Washington University in St. Louis, and you. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host. We will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, and we often talk jokingly so about how the Food Chain Radio Program is all about what's eating what. Well, today that's exactly what we are talking about, how our body renews itself by healing itself. Gosh, is that possible, Dr. Richard Veerstra, that actually is so?
Yeah, if you can't clean house, you can't survive very long as a cell. But this recycling process is critical.
And it kind of starts with hunger, does it not? Or with the starvation or putting the body under stress that autophagy really starts kicking in?
Yeah. So, when you starve yourself, one of the reasons why you're losing weight is you're actually eating yourself. And one of the most active places where you eat yourself is your muscles. So that's one of the reasons why you lose a lot of muscle mass during starvation, is that autophagy is beginning to eat your muscles.
But why not your fat?
Well, they also break down the fat, but they're sort of, the muscle is full of protein. So it's a great source of amino acids.
Mm-hmm. It's the least expensive food, right?
And it's the least expensive food. And it's also something that you can live without if you had to. So you don't want to be eating your organs. You don't want to be eating your brain, your eyes, for example. And so what you'll do is you'll choose something that you can survive without or with less of.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why muscle is a great place to get amino acids when you're starving.
Right. Well, let's turn to autophagy. Does it really, in fact, show the promise that everybody's talking about it as a biologist, you look at this, and are you seeing the hope that everybody else seems to be seeing?
Well, yeah, I think we are. And part of it is that we're starting to understand the different processes that are affected by it, and they really seem to pervade all of cell biology. Examples are leaf senescence, or our grain filling, or our nutrient allocation into corn plant as it's growing to eventually create corn seeds, or as cells are developing inside a human, connecting sort of human diseases to autophagy.
Mm-hmm.
It's really begun to help us understand how important it all is.
Is that where we're really starting to pay attention, is the relationship between human diseases and autophagy, or is this a hope in the future?
No, it's because we're starting to create those links. So we're starting to understand, you know, through defining autophagy, that, you know, here is particular genetic diseases, and we don't know what underpins it. And when finally mapped the affected genes in those people with this particular disease, they find, oh, it's an autophagy component. Well, that's interesting. So that means that something about autophagy must be critical for that function. And when it doesn't go right, you get this disease.
So,
and one of the best examples are these variety of neurological disorders that have all been connected to what's called proteotoxic stress, where generating a bunch of bad proteins that processes like autophagy don't handle.
Mm-hmm. What would be an example of those diseases?
Well, things like Alzheimer's, for example, mm-hmm. where you end up with these tau filaments. Lou Gehrig's or ALS has been connected to autophagy. Parkinson's has been connected. Huntington's has been connected. There's a variety of sort of minor genetic diseases that have been connected now to autophagy. And so it looks like many of them are because you just don't clean out the trash.
Wow.
The trash accumulates, and nerves are particularly sensitive to it. So one thing to think about is that, you know, in a human genetic disorder is that all the cells will probably have this mutation, right? And they're all affected. But nerves are particularly sensitive because of their shape. They're very long, thin cells
vulnerable.
As much as an inch long or longer. And if they have a lot of junk inside, then it makes transmission of signals very challenging.
So there it is. A significant problem might be fixable if we can figure out how to control autophagy. Figure out how to get the cells to take out the trash.
Exactly.
But is there a danger of the cells taking out too much?
Well, there's always that danger of taking out too much. Yeah. So, and we haven't seen that yet. But the most of the problems is failing to take the trash. That seems to be the major consequences that we see.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there then a way of enhancing autophagy? Do we have the tools for doing this?
So if you can figure out what's the problem, so what are these bad proteins that you're not getting rid of, so the trash, okay? And one way that we're trying to explore now is that can we make receptors that will identify this bad trash and help get rid of it? And so the idea is now we're starting to understand what these receptors are. We could engineer them for receiving or identifying any kind of protein that we're interested in. And I give you an example, which is a tantalizing one, is let's say viruses. You know, viruses infect cells,
mm-hmm.
okay, and what the cell would like to do is get rid of them, okay? And so one thing they try to do is, like, they try to block replication of these viral particles. But another one is that can we make, for example, receptors that will identify these viruses? And say this is trash, and then they will get engulfed by the phagophore.
Yeah, so we could send in the phagophores to bag them up,
and throw them into the trash. And so, even though these viral particles are continually being made, there's also systems that are continually recycling them.
So, well, how close are you to developing those receptors?
Well, I think that possibility is out there now, and so, you know, we're trying to test these things so you can make. We're trying to understand how the receptors work, and in doing so, then we can begin to manipulate them and to re-engineer them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's all quite possible.
And how does one go about re-engineering a cell receptor?
Okay, so what you want to do is you want to identify the bad protein you're interested in. So you need to make a protein that binds to it. Mm-hmm. And then you also have to design it in such a way that it will then eventually dock with that phagophore membrane surface. And so then it eventually will get engulfed. And so we already know what allows it to dock with the membrane surface. That's been described. We know the proteins. We just identified a whole series of receptors that help control it. And then all you have to do is you have to design another binding site for the trash. And you can do it by a number of ways. And one tantalizing one, for example, is you can use your own immune system in which you could feed cells, the immune system trash. They make antibodies. And then what you could do is you could take those antibodies and couple them with these binding proteins that bind to the, you know, the lining of the phagophore. And so what it'd do is it'd bind to the trash, it would then bind to the phagophore, and it would then engulf that new trash.
Wow. Now,
and so you could use your own immune system then to engineer.
So it would just be like taking a shot for polio or something like that.
That is exactly. You develop a system so that the immune system would pick it out.
Do you see any, Dr. Verster, do you see any danger in this new technology? I mean, people are always frightened with new technology.
Are there unintended consequences?
Right, there you go.
And I guess we don't know yet. And I guess because there's so many things we don't know. I think it's a relatively benign system, because one thing that's kind of interesting about autophagy is that, for example, plants can live without it. It's not essential.
Ah, really?
So we don't know exactly how they cover for it, but you can knock it out genetically and plants will grow.
Or
you can knock out yeast and yeast will grow. You can knock out into mammalian cells and they will grow.
But
if you starve them, then they don't grow.
But don't they eventually run out of room to store the trash?
They do eventually run out of room to store the trash. But if you happy cells dividing very rapidly, they can do okay.
For a while.
For a while.
For a while.
And so then, it's not essential.
Well, if we see these diseases like Alzheimer's being a consequence of not taking out the trash, then why wouldn't it be considered essential?
Well, because you live, Alzheimer's are old age diseases. I mean,
you
babies don't get Alzheimer's. So even though they don't take out the trash, what they accumulate isn't a problem. But as they get older and older and older, then the trash starts piling up until it gets to the point that they can't function any longer.
Now, this is really interesting then. With respect to young people, young organisms, autophagy is probably bubbling right along all the time, correct?
Right, yeah.
As we age, does it slow down or is it impaired somehow?
It can go down, yeah. So there's ideas that part of the problem of these genetic diseases is that autophagy slows down as you grow older.
And thus,
so could we just give it a little boost?
Mm-hmm. Can we?
Well, you theoretically could. The people are starting to describe the regulatory systems that activate autophagy. So could you put in a system that keeps it going stronger or kicks in a new way of regulating it?
Something tells me you're talking about the ultimate goal of all medicine.
Yeah. How can we live forever?
Right? There you go. The fountain of youth.
Yeah, so clearly getting rid of the trash is going to be important.
And there it is, and that's probably the holy grail of all medical research. Well, how do you describe this process to young students?
How would I describe this process to young students?
Yeah.
Well, I describe it as a way that cells have to not only build things, but they have to also have to break down things and remove them. Mm-hmm. And what this process is a way of doing that in a very simple fashion. And that is that you want to get rid of stuff, you put it in a recycling bag, this phagophore autophagosome, and then you carry it out to the trash, and you have a recycling system inside the cell that's taking that bag and converting it into usable products again.
And what do you tell those young students will happen if they don't do the job, if they don't take out the trash?
If they don't take out the trash, then just like in their own house, that it begins to fill up with junk.
And what is that?
If that junk accumulates to a certain level, it begins to impair how cells are able to grow, develop, and function.
Mm-hmm. If you don't take out the trash, pretty soon you have rats.
That's right, you have rats.
Running around the house. And what do you how do you describe the future of this research to graduate students who are coming to you and looking to you as their future?
Well, what I would say right now is that this is a wonderful era to be in terms of this kind of study, because almost everything we discover is novel and new. And so we're constantly learning new things that we didn't appreciate about this pathway. It just keeps expanding. It just keeps getting bigger. We keep finding new factors, new ways in which it participates in cell regulation. And that's really exciting. You know, whenever you get into these fields in which it sort of explodes on you, you're always finding new stuff that's cool, as opposed to working in a sort of a long-studied field where you're sort of filling in the edges and the little details. In this, we're still painting the canvas with broad strokes, and that's fun.
Yeah, in essence, you're in the wild, wild west of biology right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And what fun that is.
Yeah, it's great. It's been really exciting.
So the students can readily perceive a great future, a lot of possibility for the future here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so for them, it's great. You know, everything they discover is new.
So for regular folks who are looking at this notion that our body heals itself by eating itself, what does that mean to them?
Well, I guess you don't want to eat too much, right? Because then you'll fill up with too much.
Well,
it's important to keep your body functioning well so that you effectively take out trash.
Mm-hmm. And with respect to that, Richard, Dr. Virsta, it is said that the average person eats about 17 times a day. You know, three meals and lots of snacks. And eating like that, are we not impairing autophagy?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't think anybody done any studies on that.
Well, good. It was interesting thought, but I just think that you know, we eat a lot, and if the autophagic processes start with starvation. Yeah. It would seem like there might be the possibility if we could, you know, help things along for ourselves.
Yeah. Well, the other thing you want to do is you want to try to mitigate things that make proteins go bad. And one of the things that do that are cells under stress will have proteins go bad on them. Cells under, for example, oxidation-rich environments, their proteins then get compromised and they go bad, and autophagy needs to clean them up. So, you know, having healthy diets, making sure you get good vitamins, vitamin E, any antioxidants are really good, because what they do is they help maintain proteins in a functional state. So, you know, bad diets, not enough antioxidants, things like that, are things I would avoid.
Mm-hmm.
just to keep your cells and your proteins happy.
Perhaps we should think of eating less but eating better.
That's right. Yeah.
So there you go. Well, you know, earlier I talked about how it appears to me as though you cellular biologists are having more fun than kids in a candy store. Are you pretty much thinking that's about where you're at?
Yeah. It's a fun time. There's definitely a fun time. You know, we just had a report not too long ago that, as I talked about, that linked this disaggregates to a whole series of neurological disorders that no one had any understanding of the linkage that was there. And now, you know, it opens possibilities to start thinking about, well, how can drugs help in this process? Can mutations help in this process? That creates a lot of fun conversation.
Fun speculation, and that's probably why there's a lot of venture capital money looking at this industry and going, oh boy, the future is bright. Dr. Richard Virsta, professor of biology at Washington University in St. Louis. Thank you so much for joining us. It really was fun and learned a lot, my goodness sakes. And hope to learn a lot more in the future, because the future is bright for autophagy. Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live. You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.